Welcome to Akhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhatra AI.
Welcome, everyone. Today, we're taking a deep dive into a book many of us read as kids, but maybe only really get when we revisit it later. I'm talking about Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince. It looks simple, but wow, there's just so much underneath.
There really is. And, you know, understanding Saint-Exupéry himself is... well, it's pretty key. He wasn't just a writer. He was this pioneering pilot and aristocrat, too, a philosopher, really, whose own life full of flight, solitude, those near-death crashes, it shaped everything he wrote.
He definitely lived life intensely. And the timing here, writing this between 1940 and 43, he's in exile, right, in New York, while World War II is just tearing Europe apart.
Exactly. So this book, it's not just some whimsical tale. It feels incredibly poignant, almost like a farewell letter, wouldn't you say? Written while humanity was, well, going through its darkest hours.
A search for what matters when everything seems lost.
Precisely. He's looking for those essential human values. And he sets up this whole critique, this whole way of seeing right from the very beginning with the narrator, the pilot, and that famous drawing.
Yes, the childhood masterpiece, the boa constrictor digesting an elephant. A really powerful image, actually. Nature, scale.
Which every adult he shows it to just sees.
A hat. A boring old hat.
A hat. It's brilliant, isn't it? It immediately shows you the core problem. The failure of adult imagination. Adults just see the literal thing, the label. They need numbers, facts.
Anything quantifiable. They miss the wonder, the possibility that requires a bit of, well, faith, visually or spiritually.
And because they rejected his art, the narrator basically gives up on that part of himself. He becomes a pilot instead, you know, focusing on maps, on practical things. He sort of exiles his own inner child long before he's exiled physically.
Which makes that plane crash in the Sahara even more potent. It's not just plot setup. It's complete isolation, 1,000 miles from anywhere. Survival mode. It's like a stripping away, a forced purification almost.
Absolutely. And into that emptiness, that silence, the little prince appears. Just shows up. Golden hair. Very serious looking. And he asks this pilot, who's desperate for water, covered in engine grease.
He asks him to forget all that and just...
Please, draw me a sheep.
It's such a jolt. It forces the pilot, the narrator, to reconnect with that imaginative part of himself he buried decades ago. Okay, so let's backtrack. Where does the prince come from? Asteroid B612. What does this tiny planet tell us?
Well, B612 is tiny, like barely bigger than a house.
Yeah.
And it needs constant care. He has his routine, right? Cleaning his volcanoes, even the extinct one, because, well, you never know. It's about paying attention to potential problems, however small.
Okay, taking care of responsibilities.
But the really big lesson there is the baobab seedlings.
Ah, the baobabs. They're such a striking image. Little sprouts that look harmless.
Exactly. Right. But if you ignore them, if you let them take root, they grow enormous. They'll literally split the planet apart.
So they're a metaphor, obviously.
Clearly. For, you know, those small negative thoughts or bad habits or maybe just small acts of neglect. Things that seem tiny, but if you don't deal with them daily, they can completely overwhelm and destroy you from within. It's about vigilance. Constant daily vigilance.
So he's got the discipline down on his planet. He's handling the volcanoes, pulling the baobabs. But he leaves anyway, not because of the planet itself, but because of, well, a relationship. The rose. She complicates things, doesn't she?
Oh, massively. The rose is everything. She's why he leaves. She's the emotional heart of the whole story. She's difficult. Mm-hmm. Vain, demanding, always putting on a performance of neediness.
But vulnerable underneath it all.
Deeply vulnerable. Yeah. But she hides it behind her, what, 4 thorns? She uses manipulation, even lies, just to keep him focused on her because maybe she's afraid he won't stay otherwise.
It's that classic thing, isn't it? Pride getting in the way. She wants love, but her behavior pushes him away.
Precisely. And the prince, he's young, emotionally naive. He takes her words at face value, gets confused, hurt by her demands. And he just runs. He flees. So his whole journey across the universe, visiting these asteroids, it's fundamentally about him trying to figure out love, trying to understand what's truly important in connection.
Okay, let's follow that journey then. These visits to the neighboring asteroids, this is Saint-Exupéry, really sharpening his critique of adult life, right? What kind of spiritual poverty does the prince encounter?
Oh, they're like little perfect vignettes of failure. First up, you've got the king. He's ruling this tiny planet all by himself.
Right, the illusion of power.
Total illusion. He demands obedience, but there's no one there. It's just an empty performance of authority.
Then the vain man?
Even sadder, maybe. All he wants is applause. Admiration. His whole existence is just feeding his ego, but there's nothing substantial there. It's pure emptiness.
And then the businessman. This one always hits hard, especially today.
Doesn't it? He's just sitting there endlessly counting the stars, billions of them.
Yeah.
And he claims he owns them.
Owns the stars.
Just because he thought of counting them first.
Yeah.
It's absurd, but also deeply pointed.
This feels like more than just greed. It's like Saint-Exupéry saw something coming, didn't he? This obsession with quantifying everything, turning wonder into, what, an asset.
Exactly. Financialization. Metrics over meaning.
Mm-hmm.
He saw it. The businessman reduces the sheer wonder of the cosmos, something that belongs to everyone and no one, into a number on a ledger. He can't see the stars anymore. He just sees his figures. It's about how chasing acquisition can blind you to actual value.
Okay, but there's one character the prince does respect, surprisingly. The lamplighter.
Ah, the lamplighter. He's fascinating. His planet spins so fast he has to light and put out his lamp every single minute. Orders are orders, you know?
It's completely pointless, exhausting, absurd work. So why the respect? The king and the businessman were criticized for being empty. The lamplighter's task is meaningless.
Yes, but unlike the others, he's not doing it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Not for power, not for praise, not for profit. He's doing it out of, well, sheer dedication. Commitment to his orders, even though they make no sense and make him suffer. It's the selflessness, the dedication itself, that gives him meaning, not the task. It suggests commitment can redeem even absurdity.
That's a subtle but powerful point. Okay, last one before Earth, the geographer.
Right. The geographer only cares about eternal things, mountains, oceans, things that last. He dismisses the prince's rose because she's ephemeral, temporary.
Mm.
Flowers don't belong in serious books, he says.
Valuing theory over lived experience, abstract knowledge over what matters to the heart.
And that dismissal is what hits the prince hard. It makes him realize his rose is temporary, mortal. She could disappear. It creates this crisis, forces him to really think about her, and that's what sends him down to Earth.
And on Earth, he faces the biggest challenge to his feelings yet. The garden full of roses. Thousands of them.
Yes. His rose had told him she was unique in all the universe. And then he sees this field of them. Ordinary roses. He feels utterly betrayed, crushed. Maybe his rose wasn't special at all. Maybe his suffering was for nothing.
That disillusionment, that pain is what prepares him, isn't it, for the fox?
Exactly. The fox arrives right when the prince is at his lowest. And the fox becomes, well, the story's real teacher, the philosopher of relationships.
Teaching him about taming, which isn't about domination, is it?
Not at all. It's about creating unique bonds. It's a slow, patient process. Rituals, building trust. It takes time and effort. It's about making something or someone special to you through mutual care and responsibility. It's the opposite of those superficial adult connections.
And this process transforms how he sees his own rose and all the roses in the garden.
Completely. He realizes his rose is unique, not because she looks different from the others, but because she's the one he watered, the one he put under glass, the one he listened to, the one he tamed. Her value comes from his investment in her.
Which leads directly to those three core secrets the fox reveals. They're really the heart of the book's philosophy. Let's touch on them. The first one.
One sees clearly only with the heart. What is essential is invisible to the eye. I mean, that just cuts right through our data-driven world, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Love, loyalty, beauty, grief. You can't measure them, but they're what truly defines our lives.
Essential but invisible. Okay, and the second.
You become responsible forever for what you have tamed. This reframes love completely. It's not just a feeling that comes and goes. It's an ethical commitment, a responsibility you choose forever.
It makes connection an active choice, an obligation. And the third secret, the one that really challenges our ideas about efficiency.
It is the time you have wasted for your rose that makes your rose so important. Wasted time. In our world, that sounds terrible. But here, it's the opposite. The time spent not being productive, the time spent just being present, listening, caring. That's what creates profound value. It's a total inversion of efficiency culture.
Such powerful ideas. And they arrive just as the narrator's own survival is on the line. He's running out of water after 8 days in the desert.
Right. Their shared physical thirst mirrors a deeper spiritual thirst.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finally find that well, it's more than just water they find.
The water is described as being like a gift, good for the heart. It's the culmination of their friendship, isn't it? Shared struggle, shared relief, mutual understanding.
Absolutely. But the prince's journey is nearing its end. He's learned what he needed to learn about his rose, about love, about responsibility. He needs to go back to asteroid B612.
Which brings in the snake, the agent of departure, transformation.
All of that, I think. The prince explains quite calmly that his body is just, well, too heavy. A shell. He can't take it with him across the stars. So he arranges this meeting with the snake. He accepts the bite. It's heartbreaking, but also strangely peaceful.
It's an acceptance of mortality, maybe, but also an insistence that the connection they made, the essence of who he is, isn't tied to that physical body.
Exactly. The body is left behind, like an old shell.
Yeah.
But he leaves the narrator something incredible, a gift.
The laughter in the stars.
Yes. He tells the pilot, whenever you look up at the stars now, because my star is up there somewhere, it will be as if all the stars are laughing.
Uh-huh.
Because you'll remember my laugh.
So the connection transcends physical presence. It becomes part of the narrator's way of seeing the world.
It transforms him. He's no longer just that jaded pilot. He can see with the heart now, like the prince taught him. He carries that invisible, essential connection with him.
You know, the enduring power of this story, I think, is how it gently forces you to look at your own life. What are the baobabs I'm ignoring? What or who have I truly tamed? What deserves my wasted time?
It really does. It's a reminder that maybe the most valuable things aren't what we achieve or own, but the care, the attention, the time we pour into making our connections unique and meaningful.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by the Katra Foundation.